2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 8. Then the king of Syria warred against Israel and took counsel with his servants, saying, In such and such a place shall be my camp. And the man of God sent unto the king of Israel, saying, Beware that thou pass not such a place, for thither the Syrians are come down. And the king of Israel sent to the place which the man of God told him and warned him of, and saved himself there not once nor twice. Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled for this thing, and he called his servants and said unto them, Will ye not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? And one of his servants said, None, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet that is in Israel telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. And he said, Go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, Behold, he is in Dothan. Therefore sent he thither horses and chariots and a great host. And they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, Alas, my master, how shall we do? And he answered, Fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes, that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. And when they came down to him, Elisha prayed unto the Lord and said, Smite this people, I pray thee, with blindness. And he smote them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said unto them, This is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom ye seek. But he led them to Samaria. And it came to pass, when they were come into Samaria, that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men, that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw. And behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. And the king of Israel said unto Elisha when he saw them, My father, shall I smite them? Shall I smite them? And he answered, Thou shalt not smite them. Wouldst thou smite those whom thou hast taken captive with thy sword and with thy bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink, and go to their master. And he prepared great provision for them, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away. And they went to their master. So the bands of Syria came no more into the land of Israel. I find a great deal of my ministry is given over to things associated with the great work of the prophets of the Old Testament. Outstanding men of God who were called of God at critical times to carry his word to the nation. In the early days, of course, in the days of David, there were men like Nathan and Gad. They were prophets, and yet they didn't hold the same significant position in the nation that was held later by the prophets. You might say that men like Nathan and Gad held a position equivalent today to that of a court chaplain. But from the days of Elijah, prophecy assumed a new significance in the land. And from that time onward, the servants of God held a greater position. They had a more widespread influence. And even though people generally didn't receive their message, yet they stood for God in a very remarkable way. Many of those prophets left their writings behind them. And we have in our Old Testament prophets 17 books which are the mementos of the ministry of these men of God. But we sometimes overlook the fact that it's only a generation that separates you from the days of Elisha to the days of Amos, one of the first of the writing prophets. You may say, therefore, that from Elijah onward to the days of Malachi, you have an unbroken succession of witnesses for God. And these men each stood nobly for the Lord in his day and generation. The first two of them were vastly different, and yet they were closely related one to the other. Elijah was a great mountain of a man, but he was a very stern sort of man, a rather rugged person. I don't think we would have been very comfortable if we'd been invited to his house to tea. In fact, I don't think we'd ever have asked him to come to tea. We'd have been frightened of what he was going to say. He was a stern man for a stern age, and he was needed. Elijah was a bit of a recluse. He would go and live in the remote places. He got an embarrassing habit of disappearing just when he was wanted. So much so that on one occasion, a rather nervous servant of the Lord said to Elijah, "Well now, how can I be sure that you'll be there when I need you?" And Elijah had to give an undertaking that when he was needed, he would be there. That was the kind of man Elijah was. Now, Elisha wasn't in the least bit like that. Elisha was a sociable sort of man. He loved the company of his fellows. He was a man who mixed with society. If the court was in session, he would be there. If the king went to war, his tent would be somewhere near the tent of the king. He was always mixing, fraternizing with people, whereas Elijah was an extremely different type. Yet both of these were equally men and servants of God. Each of these men stood in his own day and generation as a witness for the Lord. How necessary it is to see and to rejoice in the fact that God has got room for every type, for every kind of temperament in the sphere of the service of Christ. The world is badly needing the Elijahs today, the rock-like men who will stand and speak the word of God. But the world is also needing the Elishas, the warm-hearted, brotherly-spirited men who will freely mix with society and get to know their fellows and deepen an understanding between them. God is very gracious, is he not, to give us a place, to give us all a place in his church. He doesn't use only one particular kind, one type of person. Now, sometimes I've heard people object to the principle of a Bible school. Now, I know you folks in Sydney don't do that because you give your wholehearted support to Emmaus. But there are people in other parts of the world who don't like Bible schools. They talk about them being unscriptural. They speak about turning men out who would all be in the mold of their teachers. Well, now, that really is rather silly talk because they haven't begun to think the matter through. Supposing you only had teaching in the realm of the local assembly, then if you had an outstanding teacher, you're just as liable to turn out a second edition of that man as you are if you put people in a Bible school. On the other hand, Elisha went to a Bible school. Elisha had a tremendous teacher. He sat at the feet of Elijah. But is he a replica of Elijah? Not in the least. He's as different as he can possibly be from Elijah. And of course, I hold the conviction very strongly that Bible schools are an excellent institution and very necessary for the future welfare of our assemblies today. And I see no possible reason why, when men sit under teachers at Bible schools, they're going to be produced as replicas of their teachers. I've never found that in regard to ministry. Why should it be so in regard to Bible schools? Of course, there's always the chap who does try and copy somebody else, but he's only the occasional person. He may indeed make himself so laughable, though he won't laugh himself, he'll be inclined to be over-serious. But he may make himself so laughable to others but nobody around him will be in danger of copying anybody else. Let's use a little common sense in talking about these matters. I sometimes think that common sense is very uncommon. Oh, that God might give us more common sense in our church affairs. Here then are two men. Elijah the great prophet, and Elisha the young man who sits at the feet of Elijah. And as you look at Elisha, you say, now this man started as a youth. He served an apprenticeship. He learned at the feet of the man of God. And you can imagine how he did it, can't you? He would sit with Elijah as he talked. He would probably cook their meals. He would do the little chores that would be necessary in their simple dwelling. And all the time he was imbibing the atmosphere of the presence of the prophet of God. There came a day when Elisha stood as the man of God. He was no longer waiting upon his master. He was no longer dependent upon his master. He stood upon his own feet, and he went forward as the Lord's servant. Now, in the passage we've just now read tonight, you find that history was repeating itself. Just as a few years before, Elisha had been Elijah's young man. Now, Elisha, in his turn, who is the prophet of God, has got a young man attending upon him. And that young man is the man around whom I feel I want to center a good deal of my remarks tonight. Now let us think of this story for a minute. The king of Syria and the king of Israel went to war. The king of Syria was a clever general. He had many plans that he made. Apparently, however, it seemed that his plans were constantly being found out. He was being frustrated in his military objectives. He began to think that there was a spy in the camp. And one of his officers said, "No, my lord, there's no spy in the camp. The trouble doesn't lie with a spy. The trouble lies with Elisha, the man of God. He knows even the things you say in the privacy of your bedroom." "Very well then," says the king, "we must make him a prisoner." They found out where Elisha was, and see what they did. They sent a host with horses and chariots. Horses, chariots, and a great host is the description in one of the verses. They must have thought that the prophet was a little bit elusive, mustn't they, to send such a mighty army to capture one man. A man that they knew wouldn't have any weapons of any kind besides. Maybe they thought that something was going to happen of a miraculous nature. However, they send and surround the place at dead of night where Elisha and his young servant are. In the morning, when Elisha's young man went out, at once his heart sank right down into its boots. He saw this host encompassing the city. He said, "Alas, master, what shall we do?" To him, everything was finished. All was up. Their service was stopped. There was the enemy in strong and in battle array surrounding them on every side. Then Elisha said a very strange thing. He said, "They that be with us are more than they that be with them." You can imagine, can't you, that the young fellow will have raised a quick query as to what he meant. Here's a young man agitated, but the older man is perfectly calm. Elisha is quite unperturbed, and from his unperturbed attitude there come these words, "They that be with us are more than they that be with them." And then, that he might set the anxiety of the young fellow at rest, he says, "Lord, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And this is what he saw. All around the area where they were was the strong host of the king of Syria. But in between where they stood and the enemy army, there was another strong host. And this strong host stood between them and their enemy, acting as a wall of defense. And it says, this is what he saw, horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. And however clever the king of Syria was, he couldn't produce one chariot of fire. Now that young man will never have lost the meaning of that moment. I can imagine what it will have meant to him in subsequent years. Always he will have gone back to this as a turning point in his life. Here was the commencement of momentum in his spiritual growth in service. You see, the difference between them was this. Elisha was the older man with a long experience of God. When Elisha said, "They that be with us are more than they that be with them," he was aware of the invisible resources, the invisible hosts of God. The young man was quite unaware of them, but Elisha well knew about them. And the young man has his eyes open to see that God throws his hosts in just when they're needed most. Thus you have the explanation of those mysterious words, "They that be with us are more than they that be with them." Now that's the story. It's a very remarkable story. It's one of the unusual stories that you find in such abundance in the second book of Kings. Have you noticed that this book, perhaps more than all Old Testament historical books, contains a number of very unusual stories? That doesn't make them any the less credible, of course. They're unusual because they were unusual days and God was doing unusual things. And this is one of the things that God was doing for the benefit of his servants of this time. Now, if that is the lesson, you see what happened. The young man was unaware of God. And suddenly he has a revelation of the hosts of God thrown into battle on their behalf. He learns something of the mighty power of the Lord, something of God's activity on behalf of his people. And as I say, things are never going to be quite the same again for this young man after this red letter experience. Now, it's true that God doesn't work quite in those visible ways today. We're living in a different age, in different circumstances. But it's also wise to remember that sometimes we draw too sharp a dividing line between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And even if now we walk by faith and not by sight, remember that means fundamentally what it meant for Old Testament believers. God is still the same God, more richly revealed to us, of course, but he's still the same God. And the God who was able to act like that for Elisha is the God who can act like that for men and women in the days in which we live. So let us see then what this may mean for us. And firstly, let's look at the young fellow. Now, the secret of succession in Christian service is for younger and older people to understand one another. It's not right that the older people shall expect unqualified and blind obedience from young people if they don't merit it. That is sheer Victorianism, but it's not biblical. If people expect the obedience and the support of young people, they've got to merit it. On the other hand, neither is it right that young people shall run individualistically in every way they wish to go without regard to their elders. How necessary it is in the life of the Christian church that there is an understanding between older and younger people. Now, do you remember there are certain occasions in the Old Testament when you get young people and older people meeting? And it's interesting to see the things that may be extracted from such occasions. Remember when Rehoboam became king? Rehoboam sought the advice of his old men, and his old men gave him counsel. And then he sought the advice of his young men, and the young man gave him counsel. He followed the counsel of the young men with disastrous results, and he lost the most of his kingdom. On that occasion, the old men were right, and the young men were wrong. You remember another occasion when three elderly men are talking with their friend Job, and they enlarge on Job's iniquities and Job's secret sins. They really haven't got very much good to say about Job, and Job gets weary of it all and he calls them miserable comforters. And when they've had their say, then a younger fellow steps in, and Elihu speaks with an inspirational message that contains a great deal that the older men had never seen. Now, Elihu wasn't perfect in all that he said, but Elihu was very much nearer the truth than Eliphaz Bildad, and Zophar. There's a clash, an approach between the older and the younger. On that occasion, the old men were wrong, and the young man was right. Do you remember still a third occasion? It was the time when they were building the temple. The second temple, after the restoration, under Joshua and Zerubbabel. And as they're building this temple, people in the distance hear a great sound, and they don't know whether it's laughing or crying. In point of fact, it was both. The old men were there, and they could remember Solomon's temple. And they could think back to the glories of Solomon's temple, and they thought, what is this? This little hulk of a thing. What is this compared with the glories of Solomon's temple? And they wept for Solomon's temple. The young men had never seen Solomon's temple. To them, this was revival. This was a wonderful thing. To them, nothing like it had happened in their lives before. And as they saw the temple arising, they rejoiced. And on that occasion, both the old men and the young men were right. Because you can understand the old men thinking back plaintively to the days of the glory of the temple. But you can understand the younger men remembering the words of the prophecy of Haggai, that the glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former. Let us remember, beloved friends, the younger and the older need to understand one another. Sometimes the older people will be right. Sometimes the younger people will be right, and don't let's forget it. And sometimes they may both be right, only with a slightly different point of view. And where we get coordination of mind, then we will get the sort of linking together and everything fitting into its place. And the work of the Lord can go on prosperously because of the joining together of the two generations. Now, it is understandable that older people shall look back. But remember, there's always a tendency to look back and to think of the wonderful days in your youth. There were giants in the land in those days, you say. 40 years ago, we had wonderful teachers. But remember, distance sometimes lends enchantment. And you may look back to the days of your youth, and you may be looking at your teachers and seeing them rather larger than life size. In actual reality, they may be no greater men than the teachers who are teaching your young people today. So whatever you do, don't try to depress the young people by reminding them of the giants you had in those days and the pygmies that exist today, because I don't think it's true. We must draw the lessons from the past, beloved friends, but we must not stay back in the past. David, after he had served his own generation by the will of God, fell on sleep. And the task of every Christian is to serve our own generation, not the 19th century or the early days of the 20th century, but to serve the present generation, coming to understand the needs of the days in which we live. And to do it most effectively, you must have a link together of the older people and the younger people. That will ensure the spiritual growth in service, whereby the work will not flag as older men get older. The work will simply grow and develop, because young people are ready to take up the threads of service and to develop their service for the Master. I remember an assembly where I had an intimate and long connection. There was a very dear brother who was there. He really was the assembly in a sense, though at one time they were up to a fellowship of close on 80 or so. He booked the speakers. He was the secretary. He paid the expenses of the speakers. He was the treasurer. He gave the notices out. He started all the hymns. Nobody would think of starting the breaking of bread meeting until he'd walked into his seat. He usually gave the first hymn out. The hall was the hall where the seats used to be around the table. They had long forms. And there were forms at the bottom of the hall, long forms at the side, and a long form at the top. And on that one long form at the top, there was a red cloth. And this elder brother and the visiting speaker for the day used to sit upon that form. They used to call it the woolsack. Nobody else was allowed to sit on that seat. I had the privilege of sitting on it when I was the visiting preacher. But if I wasn't the visiting preacher for the day, and if I happened to go there on another occasion, I was careful not to walk up there. I didn't try to take the prerogative of the preacher for the day. Now, it really became a matter for talk. And you see, the dear man though he was, he held everything in his hands. He got to be more and more feeble. He had a serious illness and he died in his 81st year. And he left behind him 4 sons and a whole group of middle-aged men, not one of whom knew how to manage the affairs of an assembly. Now that man had reached 80 years of age and he'd never prepared the next generation. These men were almost completely incompetent. And I'm saying what I know because I knew the place most intimately. Do you wonder that today that assembly has gone down and down and down? And today it's practically at 0 point. And once upon a time it was a flourishing country assembly in the south of England. It's no longer a flourishing assembly. It's a shell. Remember then, the older brethren are not to get too old before they bring others into the picture. I suggest that the ideal body of elders will contain at least one man on the younger side of life who will feel the pulse of the young people in the assembly and who will understand them. Find the wisest and the most discerning of your younger brethren and bring them to share with you in the eldership of the local church. You'll find that it will richly pay you dividends with regard to the interest and the growth of the young people in the church. Let's come back to our story then. And in this story you find a young man who is learning gradually at the feet of Elisha. But he needs to have a greater awareness of God, a more acute realization of the activities of God and of the power of God. And on this particular occasion I think he gained it in a wonderful way. The older people in the local church have got a longer experience of God than others. The younger people haven't, but sometimes when God reveals himself in some incident very sharply to a young person, it's possible that henceforth they will go forward and make more of that experience than many an older person has done. Remember then, we mustn't regard people as static, as standing still. They're not only growing in years, but they're growing spiritually all the time. This young man then, he's brought into a wider experience of God. And this becomes an essential secret for the spiritual development of our service. We talk a lot of living by faith. Well, you know what the glory of living by faith means, don't you? That you start out in the day and you don't know what God is going to do, but God may do wonderful things before the day is finished. He may step into your life in some quite unexpected manner. He may reveal his power to you. You may see him at work and you may say, "These are the ways of the Lord." So as you get wiser, you will say with the Old Testament sage, "These are but parts of his ways." The ways of God are sometimes apparently inscrutable. Sometimes they seem to be beyond our understanding. But how often he comes right down within our ken and within the realm of our understanding and lets us see himself operating. And if you see God operating in your life and in other people's lives, you're learning more about him all the time, aren't you? And this, I think, is what we all of us need. I'm sure I need it. I'm sure you need it. We need a growing awareness of God in the everyday. When the Lord Jesus Christ gave his great manifesto, the Sermon on the Mount, you remember he started by pronouncing on the true blessedness of those who were his disciples. And amongst the great beatitudes, our Savior said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." Now this may mean the hearts that were pure in the sense that they were kept clean from defilement. They were persons who, as we used to say, are keeping short accounts with God. They're having dealings with the Lord continuously and keeping their hearts ready before him, the pure in heart, and by faith they can see God. But you know, it means more than that. The pure in heart here embraces the thought of the single-hearted person, the person whose heart isn't mixed and isn't therefore distracted. Purity of heart is a singleness of heart and a singleness of motive and of purpose in life. And as we go forward, single-hearted for God, you know what you're going to see? You're going to see God at work. They shall see God. You'll see him at work in your business. You'll see him at work in your school if you're teaching. You'll see him at work in your office, in your factory, in your organization, in your shop. You'll see him at work in your home. And where would our homes be if they're not seeing the fresh activities of the Lord, day by day and week by week? It's this growing awareness of God that we all of us need. And this sense of God and the reality of God ready to step into our lives and to do wonderful things isn't to mislead us to thinking that we're going to have a series of perpetual miracles in life. He may work in very simple ways. A good many years ago, the Council of the Crusaders Union in London asked a certain author to go and see them. He had written some books, and his books were having a wide circulation. And they wanted to explain to him why they could not recommend his books to members of Crusader classes. And this is what they said. They said that they felt his books would give a wrong impression to young people. Would make young people think that all sorts of miracles were going to take place, and if they didn't see these miracles, then they might tend to be stumbled and to turn aside from the Christian life. Now, I think they were right at the time. The particular author came to a much greater degree of spiritual maturity, and the writings of his more recent years have been books quite outstanding and of quite a different type. But at that particular time, the things that he was writing were books that might easily give a false impression of life. Now for ourselves, don't let us get a false impression of life. Don't expect that there will be things done that you could do, and that the Lord is going to work miracles of a spectacular nature, but do expect that in the circumstances of life, in its daily development, you will detect the Lord at work. And this is the promise for the single-hearted in his presence. Now this, of course, is what Elisha's young man needed. And this is what he was given. He saw horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. But now, let's think of other things. The desire of the king of Syria was to stop the work of a servant of God. But the Lord didn't allow that. Elisha's work wasn't nearly finished yet. He'd got much more to do before the Lord took him home. And sometimes, you know, circumstances and the powers of the enemy do their utmost to stop and hinder our work. But so long as we walk with God, and that, of course, is essential, so long as we walk with God, he will not allow the devil to stop your work before its time is done. On one occasion, the Apostle Paul said, "Neither count I my life dear unto myself, that I might finish my course with joy, He knew that his course was not yet finished. A few years after that, however, he wrote, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished my course." He knew then that his course was finished. You see, the intervening years had filled up his service to its fullness. But Paul knew instinctively that there was much to be done before the Lord took him home. David Livingstone said that the servant of the Lord is immortal till his work is finished. And we understand what he means. If his theology is not quite accurate, we needn't concern ourselves about that. We understand exactly what he means. But until your work is finished, God has got his hand upon you. As we keep ourselves close to him and as we walk with our Lord, the Lord will help us forward to the full fruition of the work to which we're called. All the more reason, therefore, why, however old we are, we should always seek spiritual growth in service. Now remember the way in which, when Peter wrote his first epistle, the believers to whom he wrote were being troubled by a sudden outburst of persecution. Some of them were being knocked off their feet by this, and they were losing their joy. And Peter wrote this letter that he might restore the balance for them. He said, "This is the true grace of God wherein ye stand." As though he wanted to say, "Now you're standing in trouble. Never forget that you're standing in grace as well. And if you're aware of the resources of grace, you'll be far less likely to be knocked over by your trouble." Now here is a servant of God. He's surrounded by trouble. Yes, but he's surrounded by grace as well. And it's grace that's showing itself in sovereign power. The horses and chariots of fire, they were God's company in action on behalf of his people. You know, the pressure of circumstances can be very great. I've known people whose strength has been drained by constant nursing of elderly relatives. Not that they hadn't loved to do it. My wife and I have a close friend in Scotland. Some 3 years ago, her old mother celebrated her 100th birthday. And I was in Scotland, and I made a special journey out from the city of Glasgow to Barrhead to stay there for an hour or two on this great anniversary. She had a telegram from the Queen and from the Lord Provost of Glasgow and from various important people. The room was filled with bouquets of lovely flowers. People brought boxes of chocolates. She was overwhelmed with kindness. But dear old soul, she couldn't take in a great deal of it. She was enfeebled. She was just ready to go home. And not so very long afterwards, the Lord took her home. Now, for years, our friend had devotedly nursed her mother. In that 100th year of her mother's life, her brother, who was a man in his 70s, was taken ill with a mortal cancer. The old mother never knew that Willie had cancer. But Willie actually died before his mother did. And the great responsibility for it all came upon Agnes, our friend. Over the years, how faithful she's been to her family. And now, both of them have gone to be with the Lord, and yet she misses them, as you will understand. But now she has the ability to relax and have that certain amount of freedom from tension for how loyally she served. And though she would have held them both for the sake of the love she bore to them, she was wise enough to know that the Lord's plan was the best for them both. And if you met her, you wouldn't find her talking an awful lot on biblical subjects, and she wouldn't be always quoting texts to you. But you'd find a most mature Christian woman. A woman who has learned God in the various vicissitudes of life And when she passed the judgment, you would find it was a judgment worth listening to. The pressure of circumstances yields to the believer new things when we accept these things from God, and when we see that God pours His grace into the soul of His children. Now, I said a little time ago that the king of Syria was very clever, but he couldn't produce one chariot of fire, and how true that is. It was quite impossible for that to be done. He could go so far, but there was one whose power was much greater than his ever would be, and that was the living God himself. Now, sometimes we get obstacles to our service. We find we're surrounded by some obstacle. What do you do when you face an obstacle? Does it frighten you off the work? Or do you regard it as a challenge? You see, you can do one or the other. Many an assembly would be doing more for God if it wasn't so frightened and so spineless in the face of difficulties. And yet, what modern difficulties compare with the difficulties of the first century Christians, when there was no Christianity known, when local churches were far removed from one another, when the gospel was entirely a strange message? My friends, in those days, they were not daunted by the difficulties. They simply sailed forward and they overcame. If they'd been as spineless as many a modern Christian, there'd be no Christianity in the world today. Should we not take the difficulties of life, the obstacles that face us, as a challenge from God? And so, as we accept them like that, the result is going to be this: that God will overrule and God will bless. There were some people I knew very well. I was discussing with them the future of their assembly life on one occasion. It was an assembly in a country area where the center of population had shifted a little, and now they were out of center. I suggested to them that they should get a framed board, a glass-covered board, and that they should put a poster up in the center of the village every week announcing their meetings, changing the poster frequently. The answer I got was this: we've been here 50 years and everybody knows we're here. I said the parish church has been here 70 years and they're very much nearer the center of the village than you are, but they don't scruple to change a poster every week to remind the people that they're alive. My words fell on completely deaf ears. I was very sorry I'd spoken. I felt I'd burnt my fingers. And if it hadn't been for an initial sense of trust and confidence in them, I never would have said anything. They were people I knew most intimately. But there was the mentality: we've been here 50 years. What a fatal mentality. Let us remember that obstacles are not to frighten you off. Obstacles are to challenge you, that we may rise and surmount the difficulties of the day. And wherever it's done, and thank God, lots of assemblies are doing that, wherever it's done, you see an upsurge of vital spiritual life and the Lord's people moving forward for His glory. But then let's see it in another way. Sometimes the attacks of the devil are very fierce. He can attack us when we're praying. He can attack us in our Bible reading. He can drive a wedge between our souls and the Lord. One of his most successful ways is to do it by driving a wedge between different Christians. Neither give place to the devil, says the Apostle Paul on one occasion, and what he's thinking of is the devil's skill in driving a wedge between different believers. Satan will never scruple to hit a man when he's down. You will understand what I say when I say that he will adopt any foul method. Anything that is bad will be done by the devil, however respectable his guise may be. He will act subtly. Sometimes he'll come right out into the open. At another time he'll be like a poisonous serpent. Satan's attacks are unsparing. And where would we be but for the hosts of God? And there is the Lord, ready to throw the resources of heaven in for you and for me at a moment's notice. The horses and chariots of fire that were round about Elisha can be round about us in the circumstances of our life. Well then, as I close, let me ask you, can you see his chariot hosts? Have you seen them in your own life? Have you seen God letting bear his power for you, perhaps in some outstanding way? If so, you will never forget it. Greater are they that are with us than they that are with them. And despite the apparent strength of our foes, of materialism, of humanism, of communism, despite the indifference to religious matters and to everything biblical, despite the modern moral atheism of the age in which we live, still, those who stand with God are in a majority. And if our hearts can be fortified to a new strength of faith and confidence in him, you may go forward tomorrow and draw upon your knowledge of the resources of the Lord, and God will give you a happier day than you've had today. And I may do the same thing, and we may seek to commit our way to him, casting every anxiety upon him, remembering that he careth for us. Some years ago, a young lady I know, who's a trained and very skillful nurse, was serving the Lord in Tangier. She decided that she would go into the interior of Morocco, some couple of hundred miles from the coast, and she would stay within a walled city. Everybody advised her against it. The diplomatic authorities didn't want her to go. They said that no white person had ever lived inside that walled city. They couldn't stop her, however. And she went and she got an abode somewhere in one of the little narrow streets infested with people in this walled Moorish city. She took with her materials to start a daily dispensary. She opened her dispensary and nobody came. And for weeks nobody came. And then one day one of the women of the town came. And she was the one who broke the ice. And gradually, more came until it became the accepted thing that they would go to her daily dispensary. And whenever they went, they heard something of the gospel. Her father went and spent a couple of nights there with her. He told me afterwards. He said, the first night I got there, we had a knock on the door at 10 o'clock at night. He said she opened the door and there was a little Arab urchin. All he wanted was a roof over his head for the night, and he knew that he'd meet with a friendly reception there. And so Patricia let him in, and he lay down on the floor and wrapped his great garment around him as a blanket, and in a moment he was fast asleep. At 6 o'clock in the morning he got up and went out. You see, he'd come because all the reserve was broken down, and he knew that there he would find kindness and a welcome. She only left that city when it became essential to do so, because her life and the lives of other people were in danger. But the work she did there was an enduring work, and when I was in Tangier with them a few years ago, I met some of the girls. They were now nurses in the mission hospital. And she first met with them when she was in this city in the far interior of Morocco. And there, amongst enemies, amongst those who hated the gospel of Jesus Christ, this courageous young woman, with all the skills at her disposal and a perfect Arabic at her command. She labored there, laying her great gifts at the feet of the Lord Jesus Christ. And what did she see? She saw the Lord throwing out his hosts on her gifts at on her behalf, just as he did for Elijah. Let us see that the secret of spiritual growth in service is a new awareness of God and a response to the Lord. And thus, whatever our age may be, we will go on to the end of our course, constantly aware that by his grace we shall see the horses and the chariots of fire which were round about God's servant, round about his servants, in the day and age in which we live.